The briefing today unplugs people's creativity by embracing the wonder of change. It seeks inspiration from maverick innovators and change makers to share their stories, experiences, and dreams. Time goes by, and elements of the past are carried over into the futures, becoming heritage. Decisions are made on what to carry forward and what to leave behind. Maybe something will be forgotten. But how do we make such a decision on what to carry across? What are the criteria to support such a decision? What do we as humans look for into making a heritage decision? Today, we talk about the concept of heritage mindset with Richard Sanford, professor at UCL in Heritage Evidence, Foresight and Policy. Richard has a diverse area of experience, coding, education, future studies, future literacy, policy, ethnographic research. Welcome, Richard, and thank you for joining me at the briefing today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we unpack and explore the concept of heritage mindset, let's start from what makes us who we are. Education, learning. Education teaches people skills, way of thinking and doing. We start from very early on to learn and get experience and get knowledge. Education empowers the next generation to thrive in a complex environment and hopefully drive effectively our society into the futures and forward. Education itself has to adapt and change to the evolving societal context. Technology has played an important role in how education is delivered. And you have a take on this?
Wow. So I think this is especially current now, post-pandemic, when we've seen so many schools and education systems try and make use of technology to keep teaching. I suppose what's been really striking for me is how many have represented that as teaching in a new way, but the technology has been used to really cement the old relationships and the way of organising learning. So that's something that has been really cemented by what the technology companies give to people. So lots of people have thought about this way more than me. And if you're interested in how technology and education work together, I recommend that you follow, well, there's loads of people, Audrey Waters, Ben Williamson in Edinburgh, lots and lots of my old colleagues from FutureLab that I used to work for back in 2004-ish, who have been thinking about this for a very long time. And one of the things that they teach me, I suppose, is that people have been thinking about education and technology for a very long time. In the UK, there was a real battle about who was going to be, which government department would be responsible for computing technology back in the 1970s, who owned it. But the battle was between trade departments and education. So there's a particular narrative around education and technology that helps us think about it in terms of delivering, that talks about it being the future. And I think from a cultural point of view, there's a kind of, education is like a black box for thinking about the future. And if you see corporate scenarios, the kind of the lever that they pull to account for a change that they're imagining in the future is always schools. This is where we change mindsets, it's where we teach people to, you know, not be racist and work hard and to think well and look after the planet. That education is where we make that change in our imagination. And technology also has this kind of big imaginary. It's got this big kind of myth around it about being associated with the future, about it's somehow not made by people. It arrives and drives us forward and we have to keep up and get with the picture. And I think the two collide in a really sort of fertile and frankly unexamined way very often. I mean, with two big strong narratives about the future. And it's very hard to kind of make the space to stop and unpick them. I think one of the things I was privileged to sort of see back when I worked at FutureLab, so this is going back a little while and it's not an area that I've been keeping up with, but this is a non-profit affiliated with the University of Bristol working to promote educational change. And I joined from the BBC, where I've been a techie person, I've been a coder, and I joined with a mindset of more technology equals great education. And it was really nice to work with teachers and with students and with people that know knew and continue to know a lot more than I do about it, to be able to see the difference between talking about educational change and talking about the use of technology. And it's really important to keep them different, because if you just, and the coronavirus has really illustrated this, if you accept what tech companies give you, they give you the old way of doing education, but they cement it. So whereas a teacher might organize their lesson and they're teaching it in a particular way, it's changeable. If you're Google and you've got a whole software architecture around it and a whole UX around it, and you've everyone using Google Classrooms is being organized into thinking about lessons a certain way. You have assignments, you mark them like this, these people can access it, these people can't access it. All the roles, all the power relationships, all the artifacts of teaching are set. They're just made a little bit more solid by the choice of Google and Moodle and Blackboard and all the other education IT people. And that makes it harder to change. And it makes it harder to ask questions about what do we really want education to be for. And so we end up in seeing what we've got at the moment, which is a kind of quantified idea of education. I don't mean that in the data sense, although that's obviously a massive topic, but the sense that education is something that comes in lumps that you shovel on, and technology is there to shovel it on faster. We've got this narrative of learning loss during, you know, what's happened to all the kids that haven't been able to learn in the way that we've been used to over the pandemic, or they've lost the learning. So we need to find a quicker way to pipe it into them. And that goes along with technology narratives around speed and efficiency and delivery and so on. But I think the important thing, and this is where futures work is really good for this kind of thing, to stop and think, are the metaphors driving us? Is this, are we just kind of being bowled along by this narrative because it fits so well? Because actually the pandemic taught us that education could be a really interesting site for helping people flourish, for helping people understand how to see possibility, how to live with uncertainty. It could be a site for educators to help to instill hope in a generation. I mean, you know, thinking what kids in school now will be growing up in a world in which wildfires aren't news, where climate impacts aren't just limited to poor countries, where civil unrest is a feature, where borders of Europe are heavily policed, where events are often cancelled or moved because of unavoidable weather events, where supplies are hard to come by. You know, now I'm just reading off the headlines, maybe these won't go forward, but the science says that over the next 10, 20, 30 years, we can expect a lot more in the way of planetary disruption, and I imagine social disruption will follow that. So these kids need to, what we're equipping them for, we need to stop and think about, and it's not necessarily the kind of industrial education that we're focused on.
I agree. We also see a strong shift from enriching, empowering people with soft skill rather than just hard skill. The way we think, the way we frame, we approach situation in our life, in our society, and how we can be more inclusive. There is a strong point for me in trying to build practices that are more inclusive and sustainable in the way of doing and thinking as well. We see a lot of disasters around the world now, and those are not just related to the pandemic, but more to what has been discussed last week at COP26. Technology should be an enabler of innovation, of a way of thinking and reasoning and making decision better,
right,
and more consciously.
Right. And I think the key thing is just to remember that technology is made by people,
yeah,
and that they take decisions and they design it. It's not something that you have to just accept.
Yeah.
And so it's time, you know, it's worth asking a question about what is it we want to teach and what technology will help us teach that. And if that's something that's not being offered by big companies, then what's our relationship to the people that make technology? How can we make it so that our needs and values are better reflected in what they give to us? Which one of the really good things about the whole AI and ethics conversation going on, which is, it's got its own troubles and complexities, but the idea that technology is actually a cultural and political thing first is something that's a lot more widespread, which is great.
Everyone tries to innovate, but with a strong education, it's harder to deliver innovation. It's hard to create something that can be beneficial to society. Again, we are talking not just about hard skill, but we're talking about soft skill. their way of thinking, their way of reasoning, and therefore the way to build community, the way to build society, and the way to, you know, relate to the next person next to you. A lot have been discussed in COP26, the headings that you mentioned before, you know, are saying something on what we need to do and better deliver. And innovation is among us as community, as people, government, companies are doing innovation. There is a common sense of what innovation is, but there is not common language. And sometimes what someone mean with something is not what that same thing is received by the recipient. You work in different countries, in different sectors, government, education, as you are now. What are the subtle nuances that you notice, that you willingly observe or disappointingly observe in dealing with an environment that wanted to innovate?
Now, that's a really good question. And it's, I think what really struck me, so I guess the biggest move, the kind of starkest contrast, was working with Singapore. So I've had the privilege of working with a bunch of different people in Singapore, and I moved there for a quite long period of time. And what really struck me, I think, was not the obvious differences, but where people claim to be the same. It took me quite a while to realize that actually there's a kind of a particular way of talking that glosses over differences. Which isn't, I mean, it's good to have a common language. It's not a bad thing. But when we talked about innovation or education, for example, we often had very different assumptions underpinning our ideas about both of those. If you're working with other people, they might have, they might not realize that we're all just as bad at realizing how different people really are. And it wasn't until I appreciated those really big unspoken differences that I could kind of, this is going to sound very cheesy, but really appreciate what we did have in common. But what we had in common wasn't all the surface stuff. And it turned out that there were lots of words that were used in a similar way that actually we had very different understandings about. So I suppose just being mindful of that kind of thing. What was really nice was finding the different flavors, particularly around innovation, the way people talk. So I was in Singapore first time around 2006, and people were just starting to talk about Jugaad as a kind of an Indian mindset towards innovating and seeing the possibility in what's around you, which, I mean, now there's quite a lot of writing on how that concept's been appropriated. But back then it was really interesting for me because I'd not really come across a different way of thinking about innovation. And then working with colleagues in Singapore who were thinking about Kampong innovation and thinking about, so that's the Malay word for village. It's got a big part in Singaporean life and psyche. The Kampong stands for a whole bunch of values around community and resourcefulness. And seeing people kind of stand up and articulate that very local vision of what it means to innovate and do good was, again, I hadn't traveled very much at the time, and it was really good for me to hear people take a different view on things. So, yeah, I think it's always useful. But I mean, one of the interesting things about being English when you go to work in Europe is understanding that you don't own your language. I think that's something that lots of English people have a hard time accepting, that it's a global language and almost everyone else speaks it apart from English people. You just spend a lot of time very confused on the edge of meetings.
I'm 100% with you, and I'm a strong believer, supporter of letting people making as much experiences as they want and can. I'm fascinated by people that come back from traveling to, you know, exotic location, you know, and far remote corners of the world, and the lesson that they come back with, they, you know, they say, oh, I saw that, I noticed that, people do this, people do that. And by doing this, we as human, we are enriched a lot, and we can be more inclusive and sustainable in our doing and thinking. So I'm a strong believer of making many experiences, different experiences, and trying to think about of those experiences and how to bring lesson learned into our practice and our life. But let's now jump a little bit to another topic of interest that we discussed when we met last time. That you say you notice or you feel there is a theoretical gap in future studies.
Sure.
What is that for you, and you know, maybe how could we address theoretical gap?
So this is just my take on it, and lots of other people have been thinking about this for a long time. It's also something that not everybody in future studies would agree with. Whatever opinions I have here, I'm sharing, you know, quite lightly, I suppose, and tentatively, and I'm looking forward to corrections if anyone hears this who disagrees. But I suppose just from my experience, I guess there are two places where the absence of a theoretical understanding of how things change has been apparent. One is in future studies itself, and the other is in policy context, kind of in practice, I guess. So it's kind of, there's a theory bit and a practice bit. I suppose what really struck me about future studies was that lots of published work seemed to be addressing questions as if they were brand new, that were old for people studying anthropology or sociology or history, and it was as if they were attacking them for the first time and not looking around them to see what else had been done. And that was a bit odd. I mean, thinking about Wendell Bell, his work, Bell and Mao, the kind of first work in 1971, 72, that work in the Hawaii that they did, they called themselves sociologists. They were developing a sociology of the future, that their task was something that was right for sociologists and political scientists to attempt. And I don't think they had, I mean, again, lots of people will know better than me, but my impression is that they weren't trying to set up a brand new field. And so it's kind of weird to look back and think, well, it started off as quite an integrated part of the academy. And then it's got, you know, there's a paper that Bell wrote back in sort of 2000-ish where he's looking back and saying that, yeah, it didn't really work. It didn't take. Whether that's because the future was too much of an out there topic, it didn't suit, you know, there's probably people who know the history of American sociology much better than I do. I think in Europe, the connections made with peace studies and so on, the kind of the academic interest in the future was driven by different disciplinary groups. But even there, it's ended up being quite, frankly, a little bit insular. And I think one of the ways in which that's evident is that there's a real temptation within future studies to talk about methods as if they're theories.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the futures cone, that's a workshop tool. It's got ontological implications. I know there are lots of people, particularly from Swinburne, who are able to talk about those ontological implications, but they're not particularly, I mean, there's a lot of other ways of thinking about the future and time that are being developed. There's, you know, a good sort of 100, 150 years worth of thinking about the nature of time and how we experience the future. And just saying that the cone of possibilities expands as time goes on is almost willfully to ignore that. Now, that's great in a workshop. I use the cone the whole time. I think it's a fantastic mental tool to hang things on, but it doesn't do the same job as having a thorough idea of what time is and how things change.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that on the one side, lots of the futures field hasn't really engaged with other disciplines. Now, I can think of at least three people who, if they're listening to this, will be really cross and be thinking that I'm very ignorant and that I'm blind to the fact that actually future studies, whenever people talk about future studies, which they do a lot, one of the key points is it's interdisciplinary, it looks across, but I don't know that the engagement that is reflected across the whole field, I'm not just talking about one or two scholars who are particularly able. You know, I'm thinking people like Wendy Schultz, every time I speak to her, she knows that she's got a thinker in mind from another field that I've never heard of. I have to go out and find out, it turns out to be a giant in their field. She just knows everything. But for the most part, the kind of the average, you know, not the outriders, lots of papers that you see in Foresight and Futures journals don't really acknowledge the fact that lots of this thinking about society is being done.
Mm-hmm.
which is not to say they haven't got anything to contribute, but I kind of feel that the strength of the academy is not having to reinvent the wheel all the time. So I guess on that side, that's kind of, there's a gap there. There's other ways of thinking about things that are important to futures people, that futures people could engage with. And I guess that's one of the things we're trying to do at UCL. The other side was working in government and realising that the kind of natural mental model that lots of us civil servants were working with was quite mechanistic. So you'll hear talk about policy levers, this idea that you can just pull this policy lever and this outcome happens. And it's kind of like, there's a reason for that shorthand. It's you're working very fast. You tend to talk about things in quite a euphemistic and quick and you don't have time to unpack in detail what you're trying to talk about. And actually, sometimes it works very, very well. But the issue with it is that you end up kind of doing the same thing all the time. And I think even with the recent turn towards policy labs, there's a real risk, which I know lots of people working in that field are well aware of, that you end up thinking that the world, that society is the same in every part of it, that if you do this experiment in one part of the country, you can just scale it up and do it in a different part of the country and not pay attention to the particular geographical and demographic and cultural changes that might mean it doesn't work so well. So there's a kind of, in a policy context, that lack of engagement with, I guess, from my point of view, a kind of historical or sociological view on how things change, means that we end up working very hard to change very little.
Yeah,
it's very unfair to my colleagues that were better at it than me and managed to change more than I managed. So it's not a failure. But so those two things basically point to futures work in theory and in practice, I think, would benefit from more engagement with people that have thought about these questions in other places. Mm-hmm. And people like Roberto Poli have been making this this case for a while too, which is partly why he's done such a massive job of pulling together all the different groups who've been thinking about anticipation. So I don't know if you've come across his handbook of anticipation, but the kind of range of fields and disciplines represented there is immense. I think the challenge for future studies is that lots of these other fields have woken up to the future as something you can study. Mm-hmm. So certainly even in the last 5 years in sociology, there's been just this immense flowering of interest in what the future does as an object, what role it plays in how we organise our lives, how the future is a site where we can test power relations, how the right to talk about the future fits in with what we all already know about disadvantaged groups. That there are lots and lots of people doing this work, and I kind of worry that we might end up with a second. The danger on that side is you get lots of academics who don't know about future studies who are coming in and again assuming that no one's tried to ask this question before, and they need to learn as well. So I guess this is one of the things that I'm trying to do, and I'm not just me on my own, but like there's a group of us, I suppose, who are trying to join these dots and say to people in futures and foresight, it's okay to engage with the rest of the academy, it's important and useful, and also trying to tell people that, like we all do, did you know there's this thing called future studies, which has been asking these questions for a very long time.
And if you allow me to say it, thanks God that we have different views on something. In that way, we can advance knowledge, we can search for more information and try to, to sustain our point of view. But at the same time, back to our education, if you have an open mindset, we can frame our perspective in a way. But at the same time, we should be able to shift and embrace and understand the other perspective if there are inside that support the other view and not us. I found this openness to change very, very key to personally my personality, but more generally very key to innovate. Innovation is not a straight line, and it's something that we don't know, and there are so many uncertainties. So we kind of put aside something into the futures, and as uncertainties and ambiguity unfold and become more certain, we should be able to adapt our perspective and our foundation to meet the future value. Now, fascinating, and thank you for sharing your theoretical gap, because it's a good starting point for bridging this gap and trying to converse around that. sorry, another point that you made is this podcast is a play is a place to share where conversations are sparked around different topic, and it's a melting pot at the intersection of innovation, futures, and design. So any useful and valuable point are very welcome to be shared. So now let's focus on the heritage mindset. Let's try to unpack, define, tell us more about what is heritage mindset and what's the superpower of having an heritage mindset.
Yeah, thank you. Well, look, I mean, I should say I'm not the only person thinking about the links between heritage and the future. And again, this is just my take on it. But I guess thinking, you know, just referring back again to what I saw was missing when I was trying to do foresight work in a policy context, it's very tempting in practice to ignore the past. Lots of practitioners are very good, Wendy, again, at making people look at where they've come from and understanding, you know, what Paul Sappho says, to look ahead, you've got to look back twice as far, and taking a historical view on things. It's actually quite politically difficult to avoid that blank sheet idea, though. And when you're in a group, the kind of the small p politics of doing foresight work in a policy context, encourages us all to start with a blank sheet, to have a kind of T equals zero, now the present, forget the past, what can we do now? Because that's why everyone made time in their diaries to come. You know, it's kind of difficult to sit there and go back and rehash what we did or didn't do. So I guess I was concerned about that lack of awareness of where we've come from. And I was interested to see whether there might be ways of engaging foresight and futures with the past. But heritage itself, I thought, was really interesting because more than just history, which has got its own relationship to the future, heritage is a really deliberate attempt to intervene in the future. And again, there are different takes on this, but if you look around the kind of how people talk about heritage, it doesn't make any sense without an idea of the future. That the whole point of calling something heritage, as opposed to just looking after it or calling it our stuff or something, but the idea of heritage is you're passing it on. It's implicit in it. It's this idea of generations of people to come after you, that you think it's important for someone that doesn't exist yet to have access to the same thing you've got for lots of reasons, maybe because you think it's a way of continuing a particular identity. Perhaps you see it as a way of a community lasting in time. It's a way of making things that are important to you endure. But heritage is fundamentally all about the future. What was really interesting working with people in the sector was that most people will acknowledge that, you know, will acknowledge, it makes it sound very crudging. Everyone who works in heritage knows that they're all about the future. It's all about generations. You know, the National Trust slogan is for everyone, forever, you know, which is about as inclusive and as far-sighted a slogan as you could possibly make in English, you know. But I think coming from a futures and foresight background, I know it's possible to think in more detail about the future. And I think that's something that the heritage sector is only just starting to do. So, you know, it's all very well to say in the abstract, we're really responsible for the future, that we're making the future somehow, or that we're carrying these things forward, that this is for future generations, it's for people unborn who need to know this thing. If it's that important, then we ought to be better at asking who these people are and what kind of world they might live in, and what different worlds they might be living in from our starting point, and go beyond the kind of the aspirational kind of abstract gauzy cliche, and actually start learning from groups like Future Studies and Strategic Foresight to have a better idea of what that future might look like. Which, again, this is something lots of people in heritage are doing. So I've got colleagues who are at COP26 right now talking about the relationship between climate change and heritage. Our director, Professor May Cassar, she's been talking about climate damage to European heritage for 25 years. That there's lots of really good heritage science being done to say, look, the world is changing in these ways. This is what we need to do to look after our heritage. These are the new ways in which it will be threatened. You know, this has got implications for how we think about it and manage it. So it's not the case that there's no one thinking about the future in heritage, but I do think there are lots of ways that Future Studies thinks about possibility, about emergence, about new categories for understanding the world, about just enlarging your sense of what might come, that heritage professionals could really benefit from engaging with. And if you're taking responsibility, which is a key aspect of it, then you have a responsibility to think in detail about the futures that you're trying to anticipate and not just working with the assumptions that you've got. And you asked about the heritage mindset. I think there are lots of different ways of understanding that. Of course, what I've been taking from the idea of heritage is this kind of moral dimension. So heritage is fundamentally about care. Mm-hmm. That you've started, your starting point is that this matters, that whatever it is, it's something we value, it's something that it's important to us. Because it's important to us, we have a responsibility to it, we've got an obligation to it. And concepts like stewardship are really important in heritage. They are quite a different approach to thinking, to engaging with the future. Like, you're taking quite a different stance. You're thinking of yourself as quite a different person than if you're in a very technocratic kind of scenario workshop where it's very tempting to kind of adopt a scientific view from nowhere and kind of you're on some cloud somewhere looking down on the scenarios. Heritage, I think, is a way for us to write ourselves into the picture and say, right, we're in this because we want this future over that future. One of the risks with foresight work is that it can present the future in a very, well, it attempts to be quite apolitical, you know, making no judgments. But policymakers make judgments all the time. Policy teams make recommendations about preferred outcomes the whole time. So I don't think thinking about the future in this moral sense, you probably wouldn't use such pompous language, but the idea that you might have an investment in one future over another, that you might care that this future comes about, I think does have a place in policy. And I think one of the things I'm enjoying doing with heritage is using that space to try and find the ways to articulate that better.
Yeah. And from my understanding from this conversation is that we need to consider and try to hypothesize the person of the futures, you know, the a personas yeah. that hasn't been born yet, but in which scenarios they're gonna work, live, and what might be their preferences, their desire. So that's one thing. And the other one is, how do we make our decision to carry something forward? So there right. are the two things that are quite separate to some extent, but at the same time, they share something because they share the element that is carried forward.
Yes. I mean, you touched on really big questions. Again, this is a conversation that has been going on in heritage for a long time. Who gets to decide whose heritages are worth protecting? And I suppose one of that's my personal interest in this, I suppose, is helping us flip how we think about change. So the narrative that's gone with lots of futures work, I think, has been you're working with people who don't want to change, who want business as usual, and you as the futures person have come in to help them accept the idea that change might be needed and to show them a range of ways in which the world might change that isn't business as usual, and illustrates the fact that even business as usual will change. You know, there's no such thing as business as usual because the world will change around you. And that's kind of how we frame the job. And what I suppose my hunch is that that might not be true now, that going forward, change is going to be baked in, and actually what we're going to be helping people with is continuity. Mm-hmm. But unless you make an effort to find some continuity between today and tomorrow, there won't be any, because what it means to live in a place is changing. That even if you sit still in a place, that the plants and animals that you're surrounded with by will change. You know, there are places in Yorkshire that look like fire damage now, you know, that we regularly have moorland fires. That wasn't the case when I was a kid. But the bugs around us are different, the bird song's different. So the world is definitely changing, that's baked in. So there's no need for anybody to go around agitating for change as a concept. I think what futures might want to look at as a kind of a field, I suppose, as a discipline, is to think, how can we help people with that change? Mm-hmm. So how can you continue to try and act in the face of climate uncertainty? How do you make sure people just don't throw in the towel and give up? How do you plan if the world's uncertain?
Yep.
What's the point of thinking long term when you can't predict next year? And I think there's something about heritage as a potential vehicle for talking about what we want to keep the same. Now, I think historically, talking about using heritage as a way of keeping things the same has been quite a repressive and negative feature of how we deal with our culture. And I think around the world, this is something that lots of groups are wrestling with. It's not just about statues and slave trading, but that there is a narrative that says heritage exists. Well, focusing too much on heritage in the past stops you seeing the world as it is. It helps you keep people down who should be lifted up, that it can be quite a regressive force. I think that's true. So I guess the challenge that we're trying to work out as students and researchers is, what is it that can stay the same profitably?
Awesome. And I guess on that big questions, because it's big, it doesn't have one single answer.
No.
Yeah. Yes. I want to wrap up this because I guess this last question for me, it's a perfect way of finishing that can leave us time to make episode 2, you know, to be continued. It's fascinating as well from where we started, from education, teaching that build us as a human being, as a society, and how we make decision. Everything starts with education, and we never stop to educate ourselves, but we need to also apply a mindset, embrace a mindset that opens to be educated, to seek for knowledge and information. And then we move to your cross-cultural, cross-language innovation experience to get to the heritage, which is a combination of the past and the futures. Because again, from my understanding, heritage is not the past and neither the future. It's something that carries across both. And it's quite an harmonic glue of the past and the futures.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that heritage professionals will say is heritage is about the present. So it's entirely about what we value now.
Yep.
And decisions we take now. We obviously look back at the past, but it's a practice that is done in the present. We're telling ourselves stories about the past and future, but we're located now. The same thing's true for the future, that what the stories we tell about the future reflect the present. It's something we do in the present. And so they have that in common, that they're both projecting in time from a point that is really what they're about. So I suppose the opportunity I've got with this work is heritage knows, the people that work and research in heritage know that the choices they're making are informed by values. And there are fierce debates about what those values should be and whose values there are and what kind of mechanisms allow different groups' values to be part of the conversation and so on. I'm not sure, I think it's starting, but I think futures and foresight historically and traditionally hasn't really had that same space for saying, we know that when we talk about the future, we do so in a way that's shaped by our values. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that is starting to change. But perhaps that's something we can speed up a bit. But I think really the kind of, again, I'm going to mention Roberto's work, but he's been talking about the thick present for a really long time. That is a present that has duration, that's kind of big enough for things to happen in. And I think that thinking about the future and the past from the position of a thick present allows you to recognise what Riel talks about in terms of novelty, the kind of the imminent futures that surround us. I guess what I'm interested in heritage is what kind of latent futures are yet to fire around us, rather than the future being over there, somewhere that we're approaching. The future's emerging as we speak from processes that are unfolding around us right now. And I guess by combining heritage and foresight, my hope is that it makes us more sensitive to that kind of imminent possibility that surrounds us.
Yeah, I agree on that. And yeah, there is a lot of interesting questions to be answered in this field. Before we go on, what is I like to ask these questions to every guest to get to know more the guests, not just from their professional life, but also maybe personal, because sometimes we read books that are not related to our research or job. So what is your latest book or the one that you're currently reading?
So I saw your question And I'm ashamed to say, I actually thought I ought to read a book that would make a good answer. And then I read it and I thought, my God, this is fantastic. I wish I'd read it years ago. So you spurred me to fill a gap in my knowledge. Thank you. But it's Ursula Le Guin, The Left Hand of Darkness. I was absolutely mind-blowing. Fantastic book. Loved it. Loads to say about foresight. Loads to say about gender and identity and about how we relate to each other as people. It's the most human book. It's marvellous. I think the thing that's relevant maybe for this podcast is there's a community of people called the Foretellers. And what they're doing is much more based on intuition, but the aim of their intuition is to try and get to the point where they realize how pointless it is to try and answer questions about the future. And there's something there that's quite a nice corrective for those of us that like to look ahead and anticipate and tell stories about different possible futures, to say that really the end goal is to just try and sit in the present. That's what I think this time. It seems like the kind of book that if I read it again, I might think something different. Anyway, wholeheartedly recommend it for those few of you that haven't read it. So yeah, thanks again for the spur to read something good.
That's good. So yeah, Richard, thank you so much for your time, for sharing, you know, your experience, your knowledge, and also some of your questions you're trying to kind of, you know, fill with your job. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Briefing Today unplugs people's creativity by embracing the wonder of change. It seeks inspiration from maverick innovators and change makers to share their stories, experiences, and dreams.